Up, Up, and Away, Episode 38, the Halloween episode. Hello and welcome to Up, Up, and Away, the podcast dedicated to anything and everything Superman. I am your host, Mario Benessi. You know, I wish these newspaper collected editions weren't so expensive. If you're not sure what I'm talking about the collected editions that reprints all the daily and Sunday comic strips for Superman, everything from 1939 to 1966. Some of them you can get relatively inexpensively. I think the first volume, 1939 to like 1943, you can get relatively inexpensively. I think maybe $10 or so. You can get it, I think, 10 cents, lowest price, plus $3.99 shipping and handling used on Amazon. But these seem to be really pricey. At least $20 to $30 minimum. And that kind of makes me sad because I do want to collect all of these. I have a pretty good collection so far. I just need to get a couple more volumes. I need to get the last volume or so from the Golden Age stuff. I need to get the Atomic Age stuff. And then I need one more volume to complete the dailies for the Silver Age. I got the that second volume in this week, and it is awesome. It's got a lot. All the art in there was done by Wayne Boring, and I love me some Wayne Boring Superman. I'm excited to get the third volume. I just got to find it at a relatively reasonable price. Also in the mail, I got that Superman figure, and he looks great. It turns out that it is indeed the Kmart exclusive figure, just like I had thought it was. And it looks really great. The only problem I really have with it, and I know it's because Kenner reused the same mold from a lot of the G.I. Joe figures, and they just happened to have used it for this. And I also, I think, used it on a couple other Star Wars figures. There's very limited articulation, so you can't really do much with him in terms of posing him. Now, this would be fine if it weren't for the fact that the stand makes him kind of lean at a really weird angle, so you have to position him just right using his hip joints and his waist swivel, I guess would be the correct term for that, to get him to look like he's standing like a normal person. Other than that, he looks great. The fabric is awesome. I like having these cloth fabric things. I have a lot of the Star Wars ones from the 90s, and they look pretty cool. The only problem that I have with mine, and it's not even that big of a deal, there's a little bit of, like, smudging or something to that effect, like a little bit of a very small, very, very, very minor dirt stain on the Superman S on the cloth, but that's nothing. Everything else is fine. The fabric is in great condition. It's just a very small thing. I also recently won an auction for a Superman costume cape, not one of the really fancy, heavy cloth ones that flow nicely in the wind and look like something that Henry Cavill or Christopher Reeve would have worn in their films. No, just one of the ones that came with a Superman costume. It's 44 inches, so it's not going to be Henry Cavill length, probably more like Christopher Reeve length. I'm excited to get it in the mail. I got it, I think I paid 99 cents. I was the only bidder, and it's like $2.99 shipping and handling, so that should be coming in the mail for me tomorrow. And I just like wearing a Superman cape. There's something great about it. It's magical. Because even if you can't fly or lift cars above your head, wearing that cape and wearing the Superman symbol on you, it makes it feel special, you know? There's something special about it. And that's why I like it. I mean, I had made a cape for a Superman costume that I had made a couple years ago back when I was in high school, and to be honest, like 30 pounds lighter. and I made a cape for it. I actually made a yellow S to go on the back of the cape. I had used a standard red cape, and I just made my own Superman cape, and I would wear that all the time. I would take it with me whenever I would go to conventions, or I would wear it. I would do the early New 52 Action Comics look with the jeans and the t-shirt and the boots and the cape, and I would do that. you know, right before Superman gets his costume after he takes over the Brainiac situation and finds the Kryptonian bio armor. But I would wear that costume, and it would feel great to just have a cape flowing behind you. You just feel like, I don't know, it's a magical feeling. That's all I can really explain it as, folks. It's great. I love it. There's not really been a whole lot going on in the world of Superman lately. The most interesting thing, really, I guess, would be that AT&T has recently purchased Warner Brothers and, by extension, or Time Warner, rather, and DC Comics. Now, I don't know what this will mean for the Superman franchise or for the DC Comics films or for the state of the company or anything at all, really. This could be a good thing. This could be a bad thing. Hopefully it's a good thing. I don't know. It's just a thing that happened to have happened, and I saw it. In terms of comic books, wow. Phenomenal. I forgot to mention in the past episode or two episodes ago that Bizarro is finally in Red Hood and the Outlaws, and he's great. I love him so much. There's a great moment between him and Red Hood. Red Hood is working for Black Mask, or at least using that as cover to infiltrate and take them down from the inside, and he's working with Artemis and now Bizarro because Black Mask has taken a Bizarro from LexCorp, and he's going to use him for his own purposes. And Red Hood tries to comfort Bizarro, and he buys him a little Superman plushie and gives it to him. So it was a nice little moment, very cute. I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes. Trinity has been awesome. Fantastic. If you are not picking this book up, and you really should be, because it's Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, you're doing yourself a great disservice, because it's wonderful. I wish it were a bi-weekly book. Honestly. And I kind of understand why it's a monthly book, because Francis Manapal is both writing and drawing the book, and that has to take a lot of time. I can understand that. But I've been so spoiled by these books recently since Rebirth started, and I really want this to be a bi-weekly book, because I think that it would... I don't know. I like getting my comic books every week now. Everything that I'm reading is hitting the mark with me, and I'm so happy. This week's Action Comics, phenomenal. Dan Jurgens, keep doing what you're doing, because, and I know you're a great Superman writer. You've always been a great Superman writer, but everything that you've been doing for this Rebirth stuff has been knocking it out of the park. Because while I have questions, these are good questions. I want to know what's coming next. These aren't, I'm confused, what do you mean by this, questions. These are, oh, where's the story going now? What does this mean for the future? Those kind of questions. And I'm loving it. The moments between John and Clark, or Clark and Lois, or Lois and John, or all three of them together, pitch perfect. Absolutely astounding. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And I like seeing Clark as a family man, and I really knew that he would be. He's just that kind of character. And it works well. Superman has been great. The next arc that they are doing is called In the Name of the Father, and that starts next week, and it's an introduction of John Kent and Damian Wayne. So there's bound to be some fun stuff going on there, because they're two totally different characters. So I'd like to see this as a kind of precursor to the Super Sons title, which is John and Damian going off and doing adventure things together, which could be really interesting, and I think it really will be. Pretty sure Peter J. Tomasi is writing that book when that comes out in February, and he's been doing a stellar job on the Superman title. I mean, he brought in Captain Storm and the Losers for the previous two issues that they did for the Superman title, issues number 8 and 9. Captain Storm and the Losers, that's really obscure stuff. That's great. I love it. So I'm really excited to see where this goes, and there's a lot of stuff going on in the DC universe, and I'm so excited for all of it. Now, I remember in a previous episode, I had mentioned that I was going to be covering a Tales from the Bizarro World that was Halloween-themed, and I reread it, and I could have sworn that it was a lot more Halloween-based than it really was. The Halloween thing only served as an introduction to the main part of the story, which is really a Bizarro crypto story. So I decided to make a little bit of a change to my schedule. So instead of doing that issue, we're going to be covering Action Comics Annual Number 1 from November 1987. It's got a cover by Art Adams and Dick Giordano, and it's written by John Byrne, drawn by Art Adams, inks by Dick Giordano, colors by Petra Scuddies, letters by Albert de Guzman, and editor is Mike Carlin. We start out in a dark and swampy area as a girl runs from a mob. They have pitchforks and torches, the usual kind of thing, and she's running for her life. They're really gung-ho about catching this girl, and she starts running through the swamp. Now, they know that they'll probably never catch her because the swamp, she knows that area really well. Now, through dialogue, they say that her name is Skeeter. Now, she continues running, and the mob continues to follow her. And in her absent-mindedness, she finds herself back at her home. She was distracted by her thoughts, and she really can't be back at her home. If they follow her there, then they will surely find her parents, and she doesn't want anything to happen to them, so she makes a detour by allowing them to see her. So they follow her, and she jumps into the water, and she thinks to herself that she needs to stay out of sight until sunrise. The mob at this point kind of gives up. Now, they don't think that she's drowned. They think that she might have just decided to swim to the other side, and they figured that she'd know that it would take them hours to circle around the water. They eventually leave, and Skeeter goes back to her place. She's crying, and she's very upset, and she's talking to her parents, who are sitting in chairs in the dark. Elsewhere, in a little town called Fayerville, we see a car pull up, and in the car is a man named Mr. Smith and a woman named Miss Carson. Now, Mr. Smith has saved Miss Carson from being stranded on the side of the road. Her car had broken down, so he drives her into Fayerville to get her car fixed, or go see somebody about getting her car fixed. So once the two part ways, Mr. Smith goes into this little diner. He's trying to collect some information, finding out who's who and what's what of this little town. He tries to get some information out of a waitress, but the owner of this little diner tells her to get back to work. But not before Mr. Smith gets a recommendation on a little hotel to stay in. Later, Mr. Smith walks into his hotel room and he wonders to himself why he had such a difficult time getting a room. They almost didn't give him a room for some reason. He tosses his duffel bag down on the bed, and from the bag he pulls a Batman suit. So we cut to later that night. Batman is crouched over the edge of a building, and he's overlooking the city. It's a little too quiet. There's something going on. The people seem to be walking rather sluggishly, and they always seem to be walking in pairs. This is interesting, but at this moment, he hears a cry for help, and he jumps down, runs into an alleyway, and he sees that Miss Carson is dead. Her throat's been ripped out, and the blood's been drained of her body, just like in Gotham, like the others. The locals come. They have wooden stakes, and clubs, and pitchforks, and rifles. They surround him. They get him from both sides of the alleyway. Now, Batman doesn't really want to fight. These are just innocent civilians. The building ledge is much too high for him to jump to. So what he does is takes a smoke grenade from his belt and uses it to create a diversion and makes a clean getaway. Safe on a rooftop, Batman thinks to himself about how he hasn't slept in 3 days and he's been on the road for that amount of time. He left Gotham City on Wednesday, and we get a cutback to Batman in Gotham City, where a victim in Gotham City had suffered the same tragic fate as Miss Carson. Back in the present, Batman gets an idea. Now, he calls the Daily Planet, and an unnamed copy boy picks up. It's a late shift. It's like 4 in the morning. Now, the copy boy comes into Clark's office and says that somebody's on the phone claiming to be Batman. Clark picks up the phone. Batman tells Clark that he needs to get in touch with Superman, and he leaves one word for Clark to pass on to Superman for him to know that this is the actual Batman speaking. Clark has left his office and heads into a storage room. Now, that one word that Batman had given him was the word magpie. That proves to Clark that this is really Batman, and he flies off. Back in Fayerville, Batman is approached by Skeeter. She goes on about how her parents had said that he would come and that he's come to help. Superman lands in Fayerville, and he starts looking around. People are still in the streets, and families and children are still up and awake, and people are in bed, but they're not really asleep. There's something going on. He remembers that Batman had said something about mass murder, and Superman's not about to take this lightly. Now, he can't find Batman within the city limits, so he figures that he better do things by the numbers, and he goes to the police station. Now, the people at the police station are pretty happy to see Superman. I mean, this is Superman. He's going to help. But they're kind of wondering why he's all this way from Metropolis. Superman asks if the sheriff would be able to help him, and using his X-ray vision, he notices that they have some weapons. Notably, a stick that was sharpened to a point. Now, Superman doesn't know if they were just whittling or this is an actual weapon, but he finds it interesting. So he asks the sheriff if Batman had been in touch with them. The sheriff said that Batman hasn't been in touch with him, but he's really glad to see Superman. Now, a deputy wants to know if this is the real deal Superman. That's a reasonable question to ask. And the sheriff says, Donnie, take a good, hard look at this fella before you go sticking your foot in your mouth. Now he continues and says, this is Superman. It sure as hell ain't no vampire. This really piques Superman's interest. Vampires, what's he talking about? Now we cut over back to Batman, and he's following Skeeter, and she's leading him to her house. Now they come inside, and Skeeter shows him her parents, and he exclaims, good Lord. Skeeter's taken aback. Why did he say that? Why did he say good Lord? He couldn't have said that. How could he have said that? It's starting to click for Batman. Now, he's also noticed that her parents, these corpses, have been dried, almost mummified, like they've been dead for years. Batman's not entirely sure what's going on, but he's certainly going to get to the bottom of it. Now, we cut back to Superman's side of the story. Now, he's arrived at the Grant Memorial Hospital, and he's led by the sheriff. And the sheriff takes him to this ward. Now, it's got a padlock around the doors that Superman thinks to himself would hold an elephant. And the windows on the door are barred with wooden planks. The doors are opened, and inside are at least a dozen beds. And Superman is horrified at what he sees. Cutting back to Batman, Skeeter becomes furious. How could he have lied to her? She thought he was somebody else, and she's going to start taking it out on him. Now Batman's starting to falter. He's getting really weak. His thoughts are getting fuzzy, and he's getting overheated. His vision is starting to go, but he makes a last-ditch run for it. He jumps out of the house and into some quicksand. Skeeter watches him drown, and she thinks to herself that if he wasn't the one that was supposed to help, then she'll just have to do this by herself. Cutting back to Superman, he and the sheriff are talking about what's in the room. The sheriff says that he knew every one of the people in that room, and a lot of them were close friends. Now, at this moment, they hear an interesting noise. Superman uses his super peepers, and he discovers that the bars on the security ward have been broken. So Superman flies off, but not before telling the sheriff to call the National Guard. Superman goes and checks on the ward and finds that it was empty. And he thinks to himself that whatever's going on around here just came to a head. Now, Skeeter is standing right at the edge of the city limits, and she says, now, my children, rise up. Rise up and bring down vengeance on the houses of my enemies. And in the streets, the people from the ward are slowly making their way through town. Superman thinks to himself, if I remember my basic vampire lore, they aren't yet to be considered undead. They're enslaved to the vampire, or vampires, that originally attacked them. But they haven't died yet, so they can still be saved. If I can figure out a way to contain them without killing them, so far they aren't demonstrating any traditional vampire powers. I haven't seen anyone turn into a bat or a wolf or a mist. They're not even hurting anyone, just threatening. But they are doing a lot of physical damage. They've already wrecked a good quarter of the town. But maybe, in doing that, they've provided me with at least a partial solution to my containment problem. So what he does is he swoops down and he gathers all the patients from the ward, and he spins around them and creates a wall of wind to keep them contained, and then while he's still doing that, he grabs bricks from the debris and creates a wall. He just creates this giant fortress to keep them contained. Skeeter confronts Superman, and she starts to try and work her magic on him, tries to make him succumb to her will. Superman's a little bit stronger than that. It's going to take a little bit more than some hocus-pocus magic to make Superman falter. She leaps at him and scratches him. His suit's been cut, and he's been injured. But how? I mean, Superman's suit at this point is invulnerable thanks to his bioelectric aura. And he figures, wait a minute. Of course, she's a vampire. She's magic. I can be affected by magic. So the two get into a little bit of a tumble, and Superman's starting to lose. And Skeeter is transforming more and more into this grotesque beast with fangs at least 5 inches long, with white eyes and bat ears. Now she's fast. She's almost as fast as Superman. And she comes closer and closer to his neck. He's starting to succumb to her will. She prepares to bite him. She's at the nape of his neck. She's about to sink her teeth in. Only a moment of pain, Superman. And then, she's impaled by a wooden stake. It's Batman. Skeeter is surprised. She thought that Batman had died. She watched him drown. Batman says, "You saw me sink in quicksand. But if you don't lose your head, you can swim in quicksand just like in water." Superman thanks Batman for helping him, and Batman says that it's really a conflict of interest. I mean, a superpowered vampire wouldn't really be the best thing for the world now, would it? Before Batman leaves, he advises Superman to maybe get that scratch cleaned with holy water if he can. 6 hours later in Gotham City, Commissioner Gordon and Batman are overseeing the funeral of all the people that were bitten by Skeeter. And Commissioner Gordon is astounded that a little girl did all of this. "Not a little girl, Commissioner. I checked the Fayetteville Town Hall before I left. Found a birth certificate for Ellie Mae Skaggs. She was born 2 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. She and her parents became vampires over 100 years ago." And Commissioner Gordon's just glad that it's over. And Batman says that he has one last thing to attend to. He says that Commissioner Gordon and his men are free to leave if they don't feel like watching. And he's got a hammer and some wooden stakes. And he's going to make sure that they don't rise from the dead. What a spooky issue. I feel like this was the better choice for doing this episode on. I mean, there's a lot more of a horror element than the Bizarro World story. And frankly, who doesn't like a good team up with Superman and Batman? I mean, they're not really talking to each other a lot in this issue, which is fine. This is the two of them solving two different ends of the same case. But that's perfectly fine. I love the art in this issue. Art Adams does a phenomenal job at drawing a Byrne-style Superman. And he does a really good Batman. There's a lot of great work with shadows here. And one of my favorite things is when an artist does a drawing of Superman and he's in complete darkness and his cape and his Superman shield are visible. I love that so much. I can't explain why. There's just something great about it. Great issue. It's been reprinted in several volumes, I think. If I'm not mistaken, it's been reprinted in Dark Knight Over Metropolis, which contains the Dark Knight Over Metropolis 3-issue storyline where Superman ends up giving Batman a piece of kryptonite. It's reprinted in there. And it's also reprinted in Superman the Man of Steel Volume 6, which collects the John Byrne run. So if you haven't read this one, please, please, please read it. So let's jump over to this episode's Adventures of Superman. Now, this episode's Adventures of Superman is entitled The Riddle of the Chinese Jade, and it was originally broadcast on January 30th, 1953. It's written by Ben Peter Freeman and directed by Tommy Carr. Like all the other reviews, this has been written by James Lance over at the Superman homepage, so please check that out. There's some great stuff in there. Starring George Reeves as Clark Kent and Superman, Phyllis Coates as Lois Lane, Robert Shane as Inspector Henderson, Victor Sen Young as Harry Wong, Paul E. Burns as Liu Sung, James Craven as John Greer, and Gloria Saunders as Lily Sung. A story begins at night in Metropolis. A nervous Harry Wong is meeting ex-convict John Greer in a restaurant. They are planning to steal a jade figurine of Kuan Yin, the goddess of peace, from Harry's employer, Liu Sung. Wong feels the family heirloom rightfully belongs to Sung's niece, Lily, whom the young man wishes to marry. It is for this reason that Harry is working on the theft with Greer. They will use the tunnels under Wong's home and Liu Sung's curio shop in Chinatown. Greer had learned of the underground passages used during the Tang Wars from the man who had built homes and businesses in that section of the city. At 3 o'clock p.m. tomorrow, Greer and Harry will perform the heist in broad daylight. The Kuan Yin Jade is normally under heavy lock and key. However, Liu Sung wants to give it to a museum, and Daily Planet reporters Lois Lane and Clark Kent will be covering this for the Great Metropolitan Newspaper. This will be Wong and Greer's only chance to take the statue. All they will need to do is provide a diversion. As Lois and Clark get the story of the Kuan Yin Jade from Liu and Lily Sung the next day, a homemade bomb is thrown through the window of the curio shop downstairs, leaving Lily to rest on a sofa and the statue in its now open and unlocked box. Liu, Lois, and Clark go to investigate the damage and cause of the explosion. Harry and Greer have now made it to the Sung residence to take the precious figurine. Unfortunately, there is something that both Harry and Greer had not counted on. Lily has seen them steal the Kuan Yin Jade. The pair must bring Lily with them, thereby making the job more dangerous for everyone involved. Metropolis Police Inspector Bill Henderson has been called to Liu Sung's shop. As he and two bomb squad officers examine the debris, it is discovered that both Lily and the Kuan Yin Jade are missing. Henderson believes that Harry Wong is involved somehow, particularly after Clark shows him some bamboo dust that was on Wong's shirt when he had entered the store. The shavings match those in the box that once contained the Kuan Yin Jade. Worse yet, until it can be proved otherwise, Henderson suspects that Lily is in league with the criminals that had stolen the statue. Things do not look good for either Harry Wong or Lily Sung. 15 minutes have passed since Harry Wong left Liu Sung's shop to supposedly contact other employees. Harry is actually back with Greer, arguing over payment for his part in the crime. Harry intends to confess his involvement in the theft of the Kuan Yin Jade and abduction of Lily. Greer thinks this is a bad idea. Greer and Harry trade punches as Lily tries to escape with the Kuan Yin Jade. Greer knocks both Lily and Harry out, places them in the tunnels, and floods them. As water surrounds Harry and Lily, John Greer has made off with the Kuan Yin Jade. It looks like there may be no way to stop the villainous Greer's plans to sell the precious figurine. As Inspector Henderson and Clark Kent go to Harry Wong's home across the street from the curio shop, Greer has returned to the upstairs residence of Liu and Lily Sung. With the Kuan Yin Jade in hand, Greer has knocked out Liu Sung and taken Lois Lane at gunpoint. Meanwhile, Clark has heard the sound of running water. As Superman, he searches for the fastest route to get to Harry and Lily before they drown. People mill about the Man of Steel as he digs through the pavement to the underground passages. Harry Wong and Lily have been rescued successfully, but Lois is still hostage of the evil John Greer. Superman may not be able to save her in time. Superman and the police have seen Greer with Lois. Greer wants to make a deal. He'll free Lois if he's allowed to get away with the Kuan Yin Jade. As the police distract him, Superman approaches Greer. The Man of Steel knocks out the thief and rescues both Lois Lane and the Kuan Yin Jade. Now John Greer will spend his days in prison thanks to Superman. Harry Wong has confessed his involvement with John Greer in the theft of the Kuan Yin Jade and unintentional capture of Lily. He has also agreed to testify against Greer in an attempt to make amends to Liu Sung, Lily, and himself. Seeing that the young man has seen the error of his ways, Inspector Henderson has decided not to arrest Harry. Both Lois and Lily kiss Henderson as Clark Kent enters the Sung residence. "Why, Inspector, what are you trying to do? Become a Superman?" Kent asks with a wink to the audience. I really like this episode. And surprisingly, the Clark stuff is more fascinating than the Superman stuff. Now, I know both sides are really part of the same coin. I mean, it's two sides of the same coin. And, you know, you look forward to the Clark Kent stuff just as much as you look forward to the Superman stuff. But I was more interested in the Clark Kent stuff of this episode. Superman, yeah, he did some cool stuff in there. He punched through the ground. But, I mean, that's cool. He flew in the air and he took out Greer. But I was more interested in the detective kind of stuff. This was a really good episode. This is one of the better episodes, really, after the couple of filler-ish episodes. The ones that are just kind of there. They were good, but this is a really good one. And Ben Peter Freeman is a fantastic writer. He really, really knows how to write a script. And the performances are awesome. Now, I had read this in James Lance's review, and he had mentioned that this is pretty much a direct adaptation from an episode of a 1949 story for the Adventures of Superman radio show, which is pretty cool. Phyllis Coates is a phenomenal actress, and she looks stunning in this episode. Look, absolutely beautiful. Everything about this episode is just fantastic. I highly recommend this one. Though my one little thing, and it's not really that big of a thing really, is that Henderson acts a little bit out of character, but not too bad. He's written more like the radio version of Henderson instead of the TV version of Henderson, which is fine. Robert Shane still delivers a fantastic performance. I always love whenever he shows up as Henderson. He's one of the best supporting characters on this show. He's great. I absolutely love him. George Reeves, again, there's nothing that you can say about this man's performance that has not already been said before. His Clark Kent is superb. Absolute perfection. I love it. Next up, we're going to be taking a look over at the Essential Superman Encyclopedia. Armageddon 2001. The name for the future-altering event set in motion by the creation of the heroic Wave Rider who became the leader of the Linear Men, Superman's time-traveling comrades in the post-First Crisis universe. The distant future of that Earth was bleak and forbidding. There, Matt Ryder, a scientist specializing in chronautics, volunteered to be the test subject in a potentially dangerous attempt at time travel. His secret agenda, preventing the rise to power of Monarch, this future era's tyrannical ruler. Ryder knew that 40 years previously, Monarch had been one of Earth's metahumans and had murdered all of the planet's other superpowered beings, but which one had he been? As Ryder embarked on his first attempt to move through time, he was transformed into an energy being capable of both time-traveling at will and physically divining people's probable futures simply by touching them. Upon arriving at his destination, the time period of Superman and the other members of the Justice League of America, the physically transformed Ryder adopted the name Wave Rider. Ultimately, Wave Rider learned that Monarch was originally a hero known as Hawk, but he also discovered, to his horror, that all along he had been the big brother-like Monarch's unwitting pawn. Monarch had known of Ryder's intentions and facilitated the latter's voyage into the past because it would cause Hawk to become Monarch. With Superman's help, however, Wave Rider was able to change his own dreaded destiny, but not before his seer-like touch revealed a number of possible futures for Superman and his friends, and one Superman would attempt to impose a global nuclear weapons ban after a nuke detonated by Intergang killed millions, most of them citizens of Metropolis, including Lois Lane, who by then would have been Mrs. Clark Kent. But the enraged and grief-stricken Superman's campaign would become a demented rampage, resulting in the deaths of 7 American sailors and 1 Justice Leaguer, until the U.S. government would implore Batman to assassinate the renegade Man of Steel. That's in Superman Volume 2, Annual Number 3, 1991. In another possible future, Clark Kent's friend Congressman Pete Ross would begin a presidential race with Kent as his campaign manager. While on the stump, Ross would be seriously wounded by a sniper's bullet, and Clark's Superman identity would be revealed when he sprang into action to save his friend's life. Superman would then take Ross's place on the ticket and win by a landslide, setting in motion an assassination plot by Lex Luthor that Superman would have to thwart. That's in Action Comics Annual Number 3, 1991. In a third vision of things to come, Lois Lane, married to Superman in this future as well, would die while pregnant with his child. Unable to bear remaining on Earth under these circumstances, Superman would abandon his adopted planet to roam deep space. There he would eventually find love with Maxima, the ruler of the alien house of Almorak, who, in the actual post-crisis world, facilitated between opposing and aiding Superman. That's in The Adventures of Superman Annual Number 3, 1991. Ultimately, each of these possible futures was averted when Wave Rider altered the time stream to change the future world whence he had come. Armageddon, the capital of Apocalypse. It was a foul, pestilent, life-chokingly polluted slum, if slum on Apocalypse isn't in fact a redundancy. Home of Darkseid's Tower of Rage, Granny Goodness's happiness home, and the largest population of hunger dogs on the planet, it was notoriously fearsome for being patrolled by Darkseid's parademons. Armstrong, Ashbury. The blind daughter of Dirk Armstrong, a right-wing columnist for the Daily Planet of the post-crisis metropolis. At age 17, she was kidnapped by a deranged breeder of her father's rants, but was rescued by Cyrotic, aka Scorn, the prince of the other-dimensional incarnation of Kandor, whose blue skin and grotesque monstrous appearance she could not see. While joining Cyrotic on a visit to his native city, Ashbury received Kandorian goggles that restored her sight, but the resulting revelation did nothing to damage their relationship. Together, they returned to Earth, where they remained devoted companions. That's in The Adventures of Superman number 546, May 1997, Superman the Man of Steel number 68, June 1997, and others. Armstrong, Dirk. A conservative Daily Planet columnist hired by Franklin Stern, Armstrong's extreme right politics often landed him on the opposite side of an issue from Clark Kent, Lois Lane, and Perry White. It's in Superman, The Man of Tomorrow, number 6, Fall 1996. Dirk was quick to judge and frequently leapt to conclusions that more deliberative individuals might not draw, but he was sincere and never lacked the courage of his convictions, even when they didn't favor Superman, and he was therefore defying his own paper's corporate culture. When Superman's powers changed during the Superman Red, Superman Blue period, Armstrong denounced him as a super menace. That's in Superman The Man of Steel number 67, May 1997. But because of stances he took in support of the unpopular Lex Luthor, Armstrong was one of the few reporters to escape a pink slip when Luthor bought the planet and he went to work for LexCom shortly thereafter. Armstrong considered himself appropriately protective of his blind daughter, Ashbury, though, for her part, she tended to find him stifling and meddlesome. She welcomed the possibility of a permanent move to Kandor with Saratek as an escape from his suffocating possessiveness, but her father rose to the occasion by begrudgingly trying to accept Ashbury's choices, persuading her that his love and regard for her best interests were genuine. The Army of Crime, a brand of military-themed supervillains who kidnapped wealthy citizens of the Gotham City of the pre-First Crisis Earth-1. Their goal was to use the ransoms to purchase high-tech instruments of war left on Earth by the alien Weapon Master. The army was led by General Scar and included Colonel Sulfur, Major Menace, and Captain Cutlass. It was defeated in its first and only documented encounter with Superman and Batman. That's in World's Finest Comics, number 279 through 281, May through July 1982, The Army of Tomorrow. Energy-powered human mutations created on the pre-First Crisis Earth-1 as the ultimate in military efficiency engineered by the renegade scientist Calixto. The troops were distinguished by possessing two thumbs on each hand, which they banged together to discharge their energy they used as weapons. Superman freed the mutant army from Calixto's hold over them with the help of Perry White, and the troops expressed their gratitude by gifting White with cigars that gave him unusual superpowers. That's in Superman Volume 1, number 265, July 1973, and Action Comics number 436, June 1974. R. Roan, one of several citizens of the Kandor of the pre-First Crisis Earth-1 who formed the Lookalike Squad, a team of Kandorians who were doubles of Superman's friends and could, when a need arose, be recruited to impersonate them. R. Roan was a reformed criminal who was Perry White's lookalike. It's in Action Comics number 309, February 1964, and others. R. Ual, a Kryptonian Phantom Zone escapee on the pre-First Crisis Earth-1 who posed as Wonder Woman in a scheme to drain Superman's super strength. Her ruse was detected by Lois Lane when, as Wonder Woman, R'Ual faked a romantic interest in the Man of Steel not shared by the real Amazing Amazon, whom R'Ual had actually kidnapped and sidelined. That's in Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane, number 93, July 1969. R'Val, a native of the Kandor shrunk by Brainiac in the pre-First Crisis universe of Earth-1. The blonde, preening Arval was rated highest in physical and mental abilities of all Kandor's young males. On this basis, Superman chose him to be his own backup or replacement in the event the Man of Steel was killed or disabled. When the Caped Kryptonian was sidelined by a temporary loss of his superpowers, the immature Arval did indeed get his shot at being the next Superman, but proved himself unfit. With his judgment impaired by arrogance, ego, and a love of applause, Arval barely apprehended supervillains who nearly escaped justice thanks to his mistakes. Guilt-ridden over his failures, he ultimately proved his nobility when he sacrificed his own life so that Superman's powers could be restored. That's in Superman Volume 1, number 172, October 1964. So let's jump over to the super fact and the super quote. According to Adventure Comics number 294, Halloween is celebrated on May 24th on Hitray. Little Halloween super fact for you. And for the super quote, this is one of my favorite lines, or two characters having a bit of dialogue in Superman the movie. It's between the Warden and Superman right after he drops Lex Luthor off at the prison. And the Warden says, "This country is safe again, Superman, thanks to you." Superman says, "No, sir. Don't thank me, Warden. We're all part of the same team." Good night, folks.
Up, up, and away!
You listen, I can leave. a single bound. When it come to getting over you, baby, well, I can't get off the ground. And but they call me the Superman lover, yeah. Say they call me the Superman lover, yeah. But something wrong with me to see. Sometimes, baby, I can't keep up with you. I got X-ray vision, and I can see through steel too, baby. I know it's something wrong with me, 'cause I can't see through you. But they call me the Superman lover, yeah. Call me that Superman lover, yeah. But something wrong, 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 wrong. There's something wrong with me, you see. Yes, it is. Look, look up in the sky. Come on, look, look. And you'll see me flying by. Why don't you just look, look? And if you do, come on and look, look. I'm flying straight to you. They call me the Superman lover. Say they call me the Superman lover. Yeah. But something is wrong with me. You see, man. Something wrong. Rat on with the rat on here.
For more Up, Up, and Away, visit www.upupandaway.podomatic.com. The show and other Superman-related goodies can be found on Facebook by searching Up, Up, and Away Podcast, and Mario can be contacted through email at mbenesi94@yahoo.com. That's B as in boy, UPPENNESE. Up, Up, and Away is a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, and Superman and all related images are property of DC Comics and Warner Brothers Entertainment. All images and music are property of their respective owners, and no infringement is intended. This is a non-profit fan podcast. Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.